Okay, so maybe we can start. So tonight's talk, I want to focus mostly on how to overcome ill will and anger in life. Basically, I want it to be a practical talk. It's one of the things that I have found in my monastic life, that the longer I'm a monastic, the more interested I become in the practicalities of Buddhism, what we need to do, how we need to practice to move forward on this path. In the beginning, it's often easy to be a bit intellectual because there's so much stimulating things often in the Buddhist teachings and doctrines, and you want to get your head around those things, you want to understand them. But after a while, it becomes very clear that the Buddhist teachings are basically about a practice. They are about moving towards a certain goal, moving towards something positive in life. And that is what really is important about Buddhism. And it's one of those things that I have found when I have been reading the discourses of the Buddha, the so-called suttas of the Buddha, is that they actually contain an enormous amount of practical information about how to practice the Buddhist path. Often, and I think this is one of the maybe unfortunate consequences of perhaps teaching Buddhism as a curriculum in school and these kind of things, often people think that the Buddhist teachings are very theoretical and very intellectual and very dry and very non-practical and the sort of things that kind of couch potato Buddhism that you do sitting at home or whatever thinking about. But that is really, I think, a misunderstanding, unfortunately. It's a consequence of how Buddhism has been taught and is not so much a consequence of the actual teachings of Buddhism. Once you start to look at the teachings, understand them in the right way, they're actually very powerful, very practical teachings. And it's a shame that we don't get access to that power and that beauty of those teachings in the right way, so we can actually put them into use in life. So this is one of the things I want to point out. I want to, I want to talk about how to overcome ill will and anger. It's going to be a main focus. I'm going to bring in many other things as well. But I want to show you how these things are spoken about by the Buddha in the suttas, in his discourses, and how we can apply these discourses in our ordinary life. And once you get that feeling for the discourses of the Buddha, you have this treasure trove, right? This treasure trove of beautiful sayings by this great sage who lived 2,500 years ago. And you get into that treasure trove, this endless possibilities of looking at the spiritual path from different angles and different ways. And this endless inspiration is possible there. And it's so, so powerful. And this is why I like to focus on this. So one of the ways that the Buddha talks about the spiritual path is through this idea of purification. So the Buddha often talks about the whole spiritual path as an act of purification from the very beginning, from you start out to the very end. It's just purifying yourself by degrees, more and more and more. And of course, part of that is purifying ourselves of anger, right, or ill will, etc. But just to give you some idea, I think I have spoken about this here before, I'm sure I have, but to give you some idea of this, of what purification actually means, the Buddha gave this beautiful simile of what purifying the mind is all about. And he said, purifying the mind is like purifying gold. It's a similar kind of process. And when you purify gold, what you have to do is, first of all, you have to purify the gold from the coarser the problems, of course, the defilements, if you like, in the gold, right? The sand, the gravel, all the coarse stuff that's in there. And when the coarse stuff has disappeared, when the coarse stuff is out, then you have to purify the middle defilements of the gold, like the fine dust and the sand or whatever. And when that is out, you have to get the really refined stuff. And this is a process whereby you actually purify things stage by stage. And you have to follow that particular sequence, right? You can't start off trying to purify the fine dust first of all. You have to start off with the coarse stuff. And then gradually, stage by stage, you purify gold. And the mind, basically, is purified in the same way. It's a gradual thing, stage by stage. And this is one of the things I want to talk about now very initially. But the first thing that you will notice here is this idea of gold, right? The mind is equated to gold. gold, the most precious substance that, you know, is known to humanity across all cultures, wherever you go in the world, gold is like something special, right? So the mind is like the most precious thing in the world. Just like gold tends to be the most precious thing, in the same way the mind is the most precious thing. There's something, there's a potential there, something very powerful underneath. And if we can unearth that potential, we will see something very powerful and beautiful and precious in our lives. But just like gold, when gold is not refined, when gold hasn't been gotten rid of all the defilements, gold isn't beautiful, right? Gold which comes out of the ground, looks like dirt. There's nothing there. It's full of defilements. And the problem is exactly the same with the mind. When the mind is defiled, it's not beautiful because there's nothing. The defilements block the natural beauty of the mind. So in exactly the same way, once you start extracting those defilements from the gold, and when only the gold remains, when there's nothing but gold is there, it's shining, beautiful, and it's something you want to wear as an ornament, right? People want to have gold ornaments or gold watches or whatever it is, because there's something very powerful and beautiful about that. And the mind in the same way, when the mind is shorn and rid of all the defilements, the mind also becomes something very beautiful, very brilliant and very wonderful. And that is when the mind which is rid of defilements is the mind which is makes you feel so happy, right? You feel generous, you feel good-hearted when you close your eyes and you meditate. You feel this brilliance inside of you. And then you understand the real power, what the essence of this mind is. And it's something absolutely astonishingly wonderful. You read about the things in the suttas that the Buddha has to say about the mind which is rid of defilement. It is just incredibly blissful, incredibly peaceful, incredibly beautiful. It is the most powerful thing in the world, right? Everybody wants this. It's like gold, except much, much, much more than gold, right? How happy can gold make you at the end of the day? Only so happy. This is kind of the essence of what we can do in our life. Well, some of the most powerful thing that anyone can do with their lives, purify their own mind and see this power inside of you. So to be able to do that, we then have to embark on this process of purification. And just like gold, we have to remember to purify things in the right sequence, in the right stages. And in the beginning, where we really start off is like we're keeping the five precepts, right? And this is like the abandoning the coarser defilements, keeping the five precepts, being good-hearted, doing what is good and what is generous in the world. This is like the initial stages of the path. This is getting rid of the coarse defilements. And once you get rid of the coarse defilements, the gold shines a little bit more, right? How does that feel? The mind starts to brighten up a little bit. It shines a little bit more inside. Not so much, perhaps, but it starts to happen. And two of the things that are part of this initial getting rid of the coarse defilements, we're now talking about the actions of body and speech here, which are very kind of, which I find very beautifully described in the suttas. And this is a part of the what is called right speech in Buddhism. And one part of that is this idea of not speaking divisive speech, but speaking speech which leads to unity and harmony in the world. Isn't that a beautiful thing? It's not something you will actually see on most paths of what is morality and what is important to do to actually lead a good life. This idea that you actually speak in such a way that you bring people together, you create harmony, you create cohesiveness, you create a society where people look upon each other with kindly and good eyes. You don't create division between people. And what a beautiful idea that is. So look at yourself when you speak. Are you creating division or are you creating harmony? And this idea of harmony is one of those wonderful qualities there that makes the spiritual path possible. And the second aspect, which I just want to mention is in brief before I move on to the main talk tonight. The second aspect, which I also found very beautiful about the Buddhist path, is the idea that we abandoned harsh speech, right? Speech which is unpleasant and we feel is we don't really want to hear. And instead, we speak speech that is soft, right? That is desired by the many people. And speech, in the Pali, it says speech that is happy to the ear, quite literally. Kanna Sukha is the name of this speech. It means happy to the ear. So when is your ear happy? If your ear is happy, you know you're hearing this kind of speech. It's soft, right? It's beautiful. When you hear it, it's like, wow, this is very nice to hear. I can listen to this for a long time. Sometimes we know people like that, right? People who are very good with a soft speech in life. And it's like when you hear them, you feel kind of, you feel very, very happy around that kind of people. So these are two aspects of Buddhist morality which I always found very, very powerful. And what you will see, and this is one of the things that I always like to emphasize about Buddhist morality, it is not just about avoiding the bad, it's about doing the good, doing those things in life that actually create goodness. By avoiding to do the bad, you don't have a sense of remorse, your mind isn't darkened, your mind isn't kind of gray and lack of energy in there because you've done something bad. But by doing the good, you're brightening yourself up, right? You're creating a sense of beauty inside. So both of these aspects have to be done. Anyways, that is just very briefly passing through morality, because that is the coarser defilements in the mind. And then the part of the talk which I really want to talk about is when moving on to the more refined defilements. And these are the defilements of the mind itself. And these are the things that if you want to have success in meditation practice, that you really have to work on. If you work on the defilements of the mind, you will find that the meditation becomes easier. In fact, the Buddha says very beautifully, if you're able to reduce the defilements of the mind, and you're able to have this beauty inside, meditation is no longer a struggle. Meditation becomes an automatic, completely automatic process as a consequence of having a pure mind. So if you can purify your mind a little bit, you'll find every time you do that, you find meditation becomes easier, right? All you have to do is sit back, and it happens. I find that such a fascinating teaching. I know this is what Ajahn Brahm teaches all the time when he teaches meditation. You just sit back, right? You don't do anything at all. And sometimes people say, yeah, you know, you've got to do a little bit. You've got to guide the mind. You've got to do something. But actually, this is exactly what the Buddha says. And this is from a very nice sutta in the Anguttara Nikaya, and it occurs in many different places, where he says that this cannot be done by will. He's talking about the whole process of meditation from the beginning all the way to the end. And he says this cannot be performed by the will. It cannot be done by the will. And what that means is that it is a natural process that starts from a certain point, and once the process is started, it happens by itself. So when you meditate, that's why, you know, all you have to do is just relax, right? All you have to do is enjoy the present moment. And if you can do that much, the process just takes off. It's such a, I don't know, it's such a powerful teaching, right? It's just this, there's this kind of, almost this miraculous quality about it, that happiness just comes to you, peace just comes to you, and there's nothing at all that you need to do. It is so the exact reverse of how we normally live our lives. Normally, the way we live our lives is that we have to strive, we have to work. If you want to make money, if you want to have a nice house, you want to have a nice car, if you want to have all the trappings of the sensual world, that's actually a very good word for the trappings of the sensual world, because it literally traps you in the sensual world. It's a very apt word for what this is about. But if you want all that, you've got to strive, you've got to work. In meditation, we're doing the exact opposite. No striving. In fact, the more striving you do, the more of a hindrance it is to that natural process to happen by itself. So you sit back, right, and just wait. But for that process to actually work, what you have to do is you have to start off by getting rid of the middling defilements of the mind. And these are the basically the defilements of the mind that we can normally see in daily life. And the two main ones here are desire regarding the sensual world, and number two is ill will or anger. These are the two main ones. The main one I want to focus on is anger, because that I think is the one that I think everybody, maybe with a very, very few exceptions, has some problem with anger or ill will or irritation. It's something we can always work on. But I also want to say, before I move on to that, I want to say a little bit about sensuality as well. Because if, again, if you're going to really have success in deep meditation practice, it's good to have a view of sensuality that doesn't block your ability to meditate properly. So I want to just give a very brief idea of how we can deal with sensuality in daily life without kind of making it so hard that we can't really do it, but practical way for ordinary people to deal with sensuality. And what I will tell you is just this is a simile used by the Buddha. This is a place in the Majjhima Nikaya, for those of you who are familiar with the scriptures. It's nice to be a little bit familiar with the scriptures. And the Buddha is speaking to a layperson who is wandering around. And he tells this layperson that you don't really understand what the ending of all activities in life is. I will give you some similes to show you the problems of sensual desires. And he gives him seven very beautiful and very profound similes with the problem of sensual desire, in particular the sensual objects. Remember, in Buddhism, the idea of sensual desire, there's two sides to sensual desire. There's the object side, which are all the things we enjoy right in life, and there's a subjective side, which is actually the desire inside of you. And those two things come together. And this particular simile given by the Buddha is more about the objective side. And what the Buddha says, he says that all sensuality, all the sensual objects in the world, all the sensual pleasures, they are, he says, they are like borrowed goods. Right? He said it's like a rich man. It's like an ordinary man in the world. An ordinary man in the world, borrows some very nice thing from some wealthy people. He gets his beautiful carriage and his beautiful ornaments or whatever it is. He puts it all on. He goes out driving with this thing and everybody says, "Wow, look at that rich man enjoying himself." Right? And then the owners come and take back the carriage, take back all the ornaments, take back all the beautiful clothes. And then, how does he feel? He doesn't have that anymore, right? Firstly, he feels bad because he doesn't have all those beautiful things in the world that people want. And secondly, he feels bad because we tend to identify with these things, right? We identify, like, you know, if you're very, very wealthy, you identify with your wealth. And then again, you suffer as a consequence. And this is a beautiful way of looking at life. The Buddha says all the sense pleasures, all the sensual objects in our life are like borrowed goods, right? It's a very powerful simile. What it means is that sooner or later, whatever you have in life, you're going to have to give it up. Very often we have to give it up during life itself. At the very latest, you're going to have to give it up when you die. It's all borrowed goods. Everything you own, right? Your house, your car, all your belongings, all your clothes, everything is borrowed goods. So think about that. When you go back home later on, go back and have a look at all your belongings and look at them as if they are borrowed goods. It gives a very different feeling to what your belongings are like when you see them like that. You know that eventually you're going to have to give them up. So indeed, they are like borrowed goods. And once you have this idea of borrowed goods, then you start to change your view. You start to change the way you look at the world, the way you look at all these things. And what changes is that it's just, imagine yourself as if you're renting a house, right? Now, if you're renting a house, it's like borrowing a house from someone else. How much effort, how much energy, how much money are you willing to put into a house that you're renting from someone else? Maybe you put a little bit of effort into it, right? It's going to be nice. It has to be homely. You have to feel well in this house. But are you going to spend huge amounts of money kind of, you know, redecorating it and refurbishing it and building it up and painting and tiling and all these kind of things? Most likely you won't do that. You will go to the owner and say, "The house is a bit run down. Please, you know, please fix it up in these particular ways." That is what you will normally do. And so that is how you deal with a rented house. That's how you deal with borrowed goods. And in a sense, all the belongings in our life are exactly like that. They are the borrowed things in the world. And even our physical body is the same thing, right? We come into this life, into this physical body. We have it for a certain number of years, and then you have to give it up again. You borrow this body for a certain amount of time. How much effort do we want to put into this body to make it absolutely right, absolutely perfect, with all kind of exercises and all kinds of cosmetic surgery and all kinds of things that people do these days. How much do you want to do for this body here? And then, you know, after a while, it starts deteriorating anyway. And then you die and it goes to the funeral pile. It gets burnt up and all you have is a bunch of ashes. It's not really worthwhile, right? All that stuff just to get a bunch of ashes. I mean, you know, that's basically what's going on there. So this idea of borrowed goods is actually a very powerful one. It's not a very difficult one to get your head around. It's an idea that I think most people can relate to at a certain level. And the more you relate to that, the more you start to understand where the effort needs to be made. What actually really matters in life? Where do I need to put in the effort? And this, of course, from a Buddhist point of view, is in the mind, right? The mind is what you take with you into the future. The mind is what you take with you, according to Buddhism, from one life to the next one. So if you purify the mind, if you put a lot of effort into the mind, it means you can take those things with you into the future. You haven't wasted so much time on all the borrowed goods of the world, all the stuff that you have to leave behind anyway. Why put an enormous amount of energy into that? Put your energy where it matters, where it really makes sense, and where it really makes a difference. That is basically the outcome of that kind of reflection. So try that reflection. Don't force it onto yourself. Don't make it something painful and difficult. But just very gently remind yourself, it's all just borrowed goods. How much effort do I want to put into this? And gradually, it will change your view of the world, change your view of what really matters in the world. And you will find something very beautiful happens because of that. You become more peaceful. You become more content to what you have already. You don't desire so much in life. And that just takes you, propels you on this wonderful Buddhist path. And you find that when you sit down to meditate, you actually go so much deeper in your meditation practice. So try that. It's just a very simple technique to help you with getting rid of some of the defilements regarding sensuality and sensual objects. But as with so many things on the Buddhist path, it takes practice, right? You have to try it out. You have to try it a few times. And then it starts to bite. It starts to have an effect. But the main thing that I wanted to focus on today is on ill will and anger, because I think that is the area where we find often most pain and problems in life, the area where it is most profitable to spend a lot of energy, a bit of thinking and reflection on how to deal with this particular problem. And one of the most important things when we are talking about dealing with ill will and anger is that the most powerful technique that is taught by the Buddha in dealing with this is to use wisdom. Not so much willpower, but to use wisdom power. And you would have noticed if you, when I just talked about sensuality before, the way I'm talking about sensuality is not to try to push it aside, right? Not to try to kind of pretend that there is kind of push the sensual thoughts out of the mind. The way I was talking about that is also about using wisdom power. It's straight from the Buddha, using wisdom to understand the limitations of something. And that wisdom is so much more powerful on pushing us forward on the path than any willpower in the whole world. So this is the first thing to understand about how to deal with ill will, how to deal with anger. Let's try to use wisdom rather than using willpower. And you will find that very often in your ordinary life, you will find that when you get angry, you feel bad about it, right? You don't want to show your anger to other people. You don't feel too happy about this. So you kind of tend to suppress it, press it down, hold it back using willpower. This is usually what happens because this is a natural way that we tend to deal with almost anything in the world. But we need to learn a different way of dealing with anger. And if you can find this different way, this different means of dealing with it, you find it is so much more powerful. And it deals with anger in a way whereby it can actually disappear just like that. So what is this wisdom power? And it can be divided up in a number of ways. But the first step usually for using wisdom is to understand the danger of something. Once you understand that something has a certain danger, that there's a problem there, then you have the motivation, right? Once you see the danger, then you have the motivation to do something about it, to get out of it. So seeing the danger is usually the very first thing to do. Then, once you see the danger, then you have to find the skillful means of actually dealing with it. And part of that finding the skillful means is to understand what actually brings anger into existence. And this is one of the most powerful things about the Buddhist teaching, is the idea of causality in Buddhism, that everything has a cause, everything exists for a reason, right? And once you understand the causality, then you also understand the means by which to bring that anger to an end. So these are like some of the aspects of the wisdom that we have to use to get around this problem. So the first thing here is understanding the danger of anger. And this is something you can read about in the Majjhima Nikaya. This is a sutta known as the two kinds of thought spoken by the Buddha. And the Buddha says that if you look upon anger in the right way, it vanishes straight away. And the first way of looking upon anger is to understand that it leads to your own suffering and own affliction. This is number one. The second thing he says, it leads to other people's affliction. It leads to the affliction and suffering of both yourself and others. Then he says that it leads to the destruction of wisdom, right? It destroys wisdom. Very powerful thing there that anger does. It leads to a sense of dis-ease, of not feeling good about yourself. It leads to a problem within yourself. And the last thing he says, it leads away from Nibbana. So this is the problem that the Buddha specifically singles out as the problems with anger. And in each case, the Buddha said, as soon as I realized that this was a problem, that this was what was happening, as soon as that I understood this, then I gave up that anger and I moved towards the positive qualities of mind instead. So all the Buddha had to do was to recognize, actually this is not the Buddha yet, as the Buddha to be, before he was the Buddha. All he had to do was to recognize the danger in these things, and straight away the mind would turn in a different direction. So understanding the problem is a very important part of the path. Understanding that there is a real danger there. Sometimes that isn't enough. Sometimes you also have to use a bit of skillful means. I'll talk about that afterwards. But first of all, understand the problem. So what is the problem with anger? And this is not, you may think that it's very obvious what the problem of anger is, and in many ways it is. So why even talk about it? And the reason to talk about it is because the anger itself is often such a very compelling emotion, right? When you get angry, it's like a driving force inside of you that says, I must act now. I have to do this. You feel upset with someone, and the anger says, now is the time to tell this person off. Now is the time to act in a certain way. So there's a very powerful force inside of us that tends to drive our actions and drive the things that we do in life. And because of that, if you are very clear about the danger, you have a much greater ability to actually look in a different direction. So remind yourself of the danger of anger. You know those dangers already. You know how much problems, interpersonal problems it causes, right? When you get angry with someone, you often create potentially a problem for a whole lifetime afterwards. Sometimes at least for years, sometimes if you get really upset with somebody and you say the wrong thing or do the wrong thing as a consequence. So remind yourself of that. People do all kinds of crazy things in a state of anger. And sometimes we tend to think that, well, I can restrain myself, right? I can hold back. I don't have to act upon this anger. But the problem with anger is that it tends to drive us towards action. It tends, eventually, we're not able to restrain, not able to hold back. And because of that, there's a danger that one day we will actually do the wrong thing. And then it is too late, right? So remember the dangers there. Even just the danger of getting angry in ordinary life can be quite great. It creates enormous problems, and often you feel very bad about it afterwards. And of course, not only does it then create these problems for ourselves, it also creates the similar kind of problems for the people around us, right? You get angry with somebody. What is it like to be with an angry person? And we all know how unpleasant it is to be around somebody who is very angry. How difficult it is. And how beautiful it is to be around somebody who has metta, who has compassion, who is peaceful, who is at ease, who is relaxed. How easy that is in comparison. So it is we create, not only is it a problem for the person we get angry at, but often it's like this this rings in water, right? You drop the stone in water and you have this ring spreading out. And it spreads out from that person. And then it spreads out from person to person, because then they get upset. And they kind of carry it on to someone else. It has this kind of a spreading effect to other people. And kindness has the exact opposite, right? If you do something kind to someone, someone else also mellows out, they feel at peace and feel relaxed. And then they, in turn, are kind to someone else. So often has a tremendous kind of a carry-on effect throughout for other people when we get angry like that. So remember that. Remember these things. Remind yourself again and again of the potential consequences, the potential things that can happen as a consequence of anger. It can be so destructive in our society, this particular emotion. And again, if you do that, if you see this clearly and you reflect on these things, you will restrain yourself. You find it easy to turn away when this anger actually happens. But even more powerful than the idea, perhaps, that it is painful, which I think already is very powerful already, is for me the idea that it destroys wisdom. And Pali word is panya nirodhika. Nirodha quite literally means to end or to make something cease. And panya is wisdom, right? Now for me, panya, and it's not only for me, but it's also part of the way the Buddha teaches the Dhamma, panya is like the pinnacle of Buddhism, right? It's the highest thing we're trying to achieve. When you have wisdom, it means that you understand how the world works. It means you understand how you should act to create happiness for yourself and the people around you. It means you have a right view of the world. It means you do what is good. It means you can advise others about what is right and what is good in the world. So panya is like this, the highest thing we can possibly have in life when we are on a spiritual path. Certainly the highest thing in Buddhism. And then this anger, it destroys that wisdom, right? So we're actually destroying the very thing that is kind of the ultimate goal of the Buddhist practice, the highest thing that we're trying to achieve, that is being destroyed by this. When you're angry, the world gets turned upside down, right? It gets distorted. You think that what is wrong, you think what is wrong is right. And you think that what is right is wrong. And suddenly you do things that later on you regret bitterly because it was done with a defiled mind. It destroys the wisdom in life. It's a very useful tool there for you to remember that. Then it is painful in its own right, just being angry. If you are aware of the feeling of anger rather than being aware of the object of the anger, you can feel the pain inside. The problem with anger, because it is so compulsive, it tends to always focus on the object, right? The person or the thing that we're angry with. But turn your attention inward instead and feel what it feels like to be angry. What does it feel like? It feels terrible. It's painful, right? It's not a beautiful thing at all. But because it empowers us, because we feel that there's something that needs to be done, we don't really experience ourselves anymore. So try to experience yourself instead of focusing on the object, and you see something very, very unpleasant happening inside of you. And then the last one the Buddha said is it leads away from Nibbana, right? What is Nibbana? Nibbana is the extinguishing of greed, hatred and delusion. It's the extinguishment of all the defilements. It's peace. It is the highest happiness possible, right? It is away from that. It is away from all the qualities that we want in life and leads towards all those qualities that we don't want instead. So these are some of the reflections that are specifically the Buddha said that he used before his awakening. So he's trying to inspire us, trying to say, well, this is what I did. Please, you should do the same thing. So reflect on these things. I think for many of you, it's fairly obvious already that anger is a very dangerous thing and a very destructive thing in our world. But still, it is good to think about this because it gives us that little bit of extra motivation to get out of these things and to move in a different way. And sometimes we need that motivation to be able to make a difference in our lives. So try that. See if you can make it more powerful inside of you. And you will have that beautiful movement in a different direction from what you had before. But then the second thing, that is often not enough. Yes, we see the danger. But then you also need the skillful means. And one of the things that the Buddha, of course, talks about, as I mentioned before, is the causality. What is that causes anger? And what causes anger is always the same thing. It is seeing something unpleasant, something you don't like, something which it doesn't feel good to you, whether it's someone else's speech or whatever it is, something which kind of grates, and then you get upset. When you see the non-beautiful in the world, the non-beautiful in the people around you, that is when you get upset. So what that means is that if we're not going to get upset, right, it's very simple. All we have to do is not focus on those negative things. If you don't focus on those negative things, you're not going to get angry. It's really as simple as that. So the whole trick of the Buddhist practice to move away from anger is to understand, to see that now I'm focusing on qualities that are going to give rise to anger. So I should focus my attention somewhere else instead. Not on where the anger will arise, but on where kindness will arise or goodness will arise. Or at the very least, neutrality in the mind will arise instead. This is as simple as that. It's incredibly easy, right? So if it is so easy, why don't we all do it? And the reason why we don't all do it is because the habits are so strong. So we have to learn to overcome the habits of the mind. The habits of the mind always drive us down the same track, right? This is very obvious in family life. Okay, I'm a monk. I haven't been living with my family for a long time. But I go back every year or two, I go back to my family. And I visit my parents, right? And the things that upset me 20 years ago still have a little bit of ability to upset you, right? I feel, you know, I've been a monk for 20 years. What have I been doing? This is and this is the way it is. It just shows you the habits are so ingrained, right? They're so deep-seated. And this is why, even though we understand the mechanism, we actually have to put in the work to be able to overcome these things. And remember that work in Buddhism, again, is this work of wisdom. All you have to do is persevere. You have to be committed. You have to do it again and again. And then gradually, because of that, you will overcome these things. So what does the Buddha recommend? How do we overcome this? And this is another of the Buddha's discourses found in the Anguttara Nikaya, which I found very, very beautiful and nice. And the Buddha basically showed, it's actually Venerable Sariputta. Venerable Sariputta was the Buddha's right-hand disciple. And he gave a large number of teachings as well, also recorded in the Pali Canon. And Venerable Sariputta says that when you see that someone has bad qualities in them, for example, they have bad qualities of the body, then you should focus on the good qualities of speech instead, right? So when you see the bad qualities of the body, you should actually instead focus on the good quality, another aspect of that personality. For example, the good qualities of speech that person has. That is all you have to do. So, and this is a very beautiful teaching, right? We know that the vast majority of people in this world have a large number of qualities, some good, some bad. And all you have to do is focus your attention away from the bad ones and onto the good ones. That's all you have to do. And the Buddha gives this beautiful simile about this. He shows that the simile is, it's a monk walking around the roadside, and this is a rag robe wearing monk. I'm a bit embarrassed to say I don't have a rag robe. It's nice to have a rag robe with a few patches and things. Unfortunately, I haven't got that. There are monks who have rag robes. This monk next to me, one of his robes is quite raggy. It's very nice. when you are a kind of rag robe monk, right? When you walk along the road, you're always on the lookout for rags, right? Where can I find a rag? Because you always need something to patch your robe with. So this simile is this rag robe wearing monk walking around the roadside, seeing a rag on the roadside. Ah, a rag, right? So he gets the rag. And what he does with that rag, which has been thrown away, he takes it, he holds it down, right? And he tears off those sections that are useless. When you have a rag, there's always going to be parts of that rag which can't be used because they're full of oil or they're full of whatever or they are rotten or whatever it is. You tear off all those sections. You throw those away. And then you take the part of the rag that you can use with you. In the same way, with a person, when you see a person, you take the qualities of that person that are bad. You tear them away, right? You throw them out. They are rubbish. They are garbage. You don't want to put your mind on garbage. Do you want to think about garbage? This is what it is. All the negative qualities, bad qualities are garbage. Just like that little piece of rag on the roadside. You chuck away the garbage and then you take the good qualities with you. You carry those with you in your mind and you walk along with those good qualities. So this is what we should all be doing here. So remember that. It's a beautiful simile, right? This idea of chucking out the garbage. So what you have to do is you have to remind yourself. Learn, there are certain people in life perhaps that you find difficult, right? You find hard. So remember the good qualities in those people. Not only that, but not just that there are certain people who are difficult, but everybody irritates us every now and again, right? It's very hard to find someone who never irritates us. So because of that, remember that these people who irritate you, they also have beautiful qualities. And this is one of the things I try to do in the meditation here tonight. I try to remind you that everyone in this room is a beautiful person. It's so wonderful to have a congregation of people like this. People who are on a spiritual path, who try to practice precepts and kindness. What a wonderful community, right? So you have to remember that. Remember those qualities. What does it matter if they are a little bit irritating sometimes? It's nothing compared to all the beauty in this congregation, right? So you just, in this assembly or whatever you want to call it, this group of people. So you focus on that. You move your mind across, away from that little irritation, which is completely, utterly irrelevant. In fact, it's pure garbage. Throw it out and then focus on the goodness instead. There's so much goodness there to focus on. And this is the beautiful thing we can do, in particular when we are together with people we know have many beautiful qualities. So that is the first simile that the Buddha uses, Venerable Sariputta uses. The next one he uses, he says that sometimes that people have maybe other qualities that are bad and some other qualities that are good. And then he uses a different simile for the same, basically to make the same point. And he says it's as if a person is walking along and they are very thirsty, they are very hot, the weather is very sweaty. Like, I mean, India and Australia have at least that thing in common, that the weather gets very hot in both places. So you get something that's really, really hot, right? Really sweaty, and you are really, really thirsty. This person then comes to a pond, right? And a pond with beautiful, clean water. And we all know how wonderful it is to have a glass of water if you're really, really thirsty, right? If you're really thirsty, a glass of water is just so beautiful. So what this person does, it kind of dives into the pond, pushes aside all the algae, all the, you know, all the water plants and all the stuff. That's like the rubbish. Pushes that aside. And then he drinks from that pure water, right? That's the simile here. In exactly the same way, when we see, when we have a person which has both good and bad qualities, we push aside all those bad qualities. We don't want to have anything to do with those things. We push them aside. And then we drink from the good qualities. We imbibe the good qualities, right? You come there, you are thirsty and parched and hot, and you need a drink. That's the anger, right? When you're angry, you're hot inside. You need something to cool you down. And what cools you down? You drink those beautiful qualities in other people, and they cool you down. And then it's just like drinking the cool water out there. It's another beautiful simile, isn't it? The beautiful qualities are there to cool us down, to make us more relaxed and more at ease. So those are two of the similes used by the Buddha there, and maybe you can use those for yourself. The next thing that, not the Buddha, Venerable Sariputta, I should say again, the next thing he says is that sometimes there are people who have very few good qualities. They may just have a little bit of good quality, right? Maybe they are really rough and difficult, but maybe there's one aspect of them which is very nice. Maybe they are generous, or maybe they sometimes do an act of kindness towards someone. Everybody, it's very hard to find somebody who hasn't got any kind of redeeming qualities, right? The kind of 100% bad person is very rare in this world. Usually people have a little bit of goodness in their hair. So sometimes you find that little bit of goodness. And of course, when it's only a small amount, you have to focus very narrowly, right? If you look a little bit to the left, oops, bad quality. A little bit to the right, bad quality. So focus down very narrowly. That's what you have to do. And the Buddha says, this is like when you walk along, and again, you are thirsty and parched and you're hot, and you see a little puddle of water, right? And it's a tiny puddle of water, and you know that if you're not careful, you will stir up that water, and it will get very muddy and very bad, and you can't drink from that water. So Venerable Sariputta says, what you do is you do what the cow does, and you get down on all four, And then you put your mouth down and you suck up that water with your mouth right there and then, just like a cow. That's actually the simile used there. So you pretend that you're a cow for a while and you drink that water, right? And again, even if it's just a small amount of water, a small puddle there, if you drink it, it cools you again, right? It takes away the heat of those defilements, the heat of that anger, and it cools you down and you feel good. And it's amazing that this actually is possible. Sometimes I think to myself, I can't do this. How am I able to actually focus so narrowly on a certain person's qualities, not to see anything to the left or anything to the right? How can I do that? But the thing is, you can do that. If you want to, you can do that. And the trick is only to remember that, isn't it wonderful that somebody has a beautiful quality? It's not given that we should have good qualities. And here somebody has a good quality. Isn't that a great thing? And once you see that, the wonder in that and the beauty in that, you're actually able to focus on that. And to help you out, of course, what is also very helpful to do in that kind of situation is to understand and to forgive the bad qualities, right? This is also very useful. So how do you forgive and let go of the bad qualities? Well, just remind yourself that we are all so incredibly conditioned in this life. We come from an unfathomable past. We come from a childhood, an upbringing, schools, all these kind of things, work, whatever it is. All these pressures around us, things from past lives that we have no idea about. How can we judge anybody else for doing bad things? We don't know where they're coming from, right? With all those pressures on us, it is not strange. It is quite natural that people should have all kind of strange and bad qualities. And when you recognize that, you can forgive those bad qualities. It is just the world. It is just samsara, just conditions, cause and conditions that have made people in this way. It's a very powerful reflection, right? And when you remember that, you can forgive almost anything. And then there is a good quality there, right? Despite all those bad cause and condition is even a good quality. And you think, how wonderful that is. And then you can focus very narrowly on that good quality. So you have to train yourself. Try it again and again and again. And eventually you will be able to do that. And then you can drink from that beautiful quality. And you will cool down. And you will feel at ease. And you will feel relaxed. But be quick, right? Don't allow the heat to get too strong. If the heat gets too strong, you can't really cool down with the good qualities anymore. See that the heat is just about to arise. Now is the time to drink before it gets too hot. And then you will succeed. And then Venerable Sariputta says, the next thing he says, and of course this is also very important for everybody, and that is the idea, what if somebody just, you can see in them is bad qualities. It may be the case that everybody has good qualities, but sometimes we just can't see it, right? We are blindly to other people's good qualities. And this is so common in life, because we are, because of our own defilements or because of whatever else, we just can't see the good qualities in somebody else. So what do you do when you can't see the good qualities in someone else? Or if somebody really is really, really bad, right? What do we do then? And what Venerable Sariputta says is that it's just like someone is really ill and really sick, and they're walking along a country road far away from the village they came from, and they have a long way to go to the next village. There's no doctor there. There's nobody to look after them. There's nobody to give them medicine. There's nobody to give them food. And they're gravely ill. So how do you feel about a person like that? A person who's gravely ill, probably about to die, right? And there's nobody to help them. How do you feel? You feel compassion. How do you feel if somebody is really sick and you see them in bed? Do you tell them, it's your fault, it's your problem, you know, enough, I'm not going to do anything? Or do you feel a sense of compassion when somebody is really ill? Usually you feel compassion, right? Because you know it's not really their fault that they are ill. Illness just happens. It's part of having a body. So when somebody is really sick, okay, I will help you out because you feel compassion towards them. That is how you should feel towards somebody who only has bad qualities. Compassion. Because if somebody has only bad qualities, they are moving towards suffering for themselves. Just like the person who is ill, who is sick, is moving towards suffering, more and more suffering, eventually perhaps death. In the same way, somebody who has really bad qualities are going to suffer enormously in this life, and even more so after they pass away, according to the Buddhist idea of karma. So when you see somebody with bad qualities, all you need to have is compassion. Remember, they are an ill person. They're like your mother or your father or your child who is sick, or your brother and sister, or whoever it is who is sick and ill and in a terrible state. That is what they are like, right? So how should you feel? You should have compassion. So again, what a beautiful thing that is. If we can make that shift. And the nice thing about that is that we kind of take away the problem often with life, is that we feel things are so personal, right? They are being nasty to us. They are bad, evil people, because I am suffering because of them. So it's personal. It's them against me. And that is the problem. But actually, it's not them against me at all. It is that this person is suffering enormously. They are moving towards their own suffering in the future. They have a serious problem, and they probably can't change because the conditioning that they are under is so powerful. They are incapable of moving in a different direction. The habits are so strong. The tracks they have, kind of grooves they have made for themselves in life, are so strong. They're incapable of moving in a different direction. Then you can forgive, right? Then you can say, it's okay, I can forgive you, I can let go of all that. So that is the really bad person, the really scallywag. You can't see anything good in them. And then the last person, which also is very interesting. This is the last person that Sariputta talks about. And this is the person who is completely beautiful, right? Who always does the right thing, who always says the right thing, who always thinks kind thoughts. These are like the kind of the people with lots of metta in their heart, lots of kindness all the time, you know. And we all know that there are people out there in the world like that. And sometimes we get angry with those as well, right? This is the strange thing. You know, you read the suttas, and then people get angry with the Buddha. They go up to the Buddha and say, you terrible person, to the Buddha. And the Buddha just sits there and says, and you know, he says different things depending on the occasion, but he never gets upset back, right? But of course, with that kind of people, it's quite easy. All you have to do is remind yourself of the good qualities. And these kind of people, the people who have really good qualities in this world, even though we might get upset with them occasionally, we remember the good qualities. When we remember the good qualities, we can really drink those up. And we can feel a sense of inspiration by such beautiful people in the world. And there are so many such people, lots of people like that in the world, even today. People who are very beautiful. And though they will inspire you. They will show you what is possible. They will show you where you too can go in the future. And of course, some of the greatest examples in the suttas of such people are the arahants, right? The awakened ones, the ones who have traveled the Buddhist path to the end and who have understood the Buddha's teachings to the full. These are the arahants. And these people are so inspiring. They are so inspiring because they are completely harmless, because they have so much metta, because they have so much kindness, because they have so much peace. And when you come into their presence, all you feel is safety. You feel safe. You feel relaxed. You feel at ease. You feel no ego, right? There's nothing to threaten you there. Sometimes you don't even see them. They just sit there in the corner. You have no idea that they're there because they have no ego and nothing to prove in the world. And this, it's one of those nice things. I don't know if many of you have read. There's one of Ajahn Brahm's book is a book called The Art of Disappearing, right? So the very last chapter of that book, he has this chapter of this very famous teacher in Thailand called Ajahn Tate. He was very famous, and he was known. Many people thought he was an arahant. You cannot be sure about these things, but for him, many people thought he was an arahant. And Ajahn Brahm tells the time when he went to see this monk. And this monk lived in this enormous building on the banks of the river Mekong, the big, big Mekong River, which goes through Thailand, between the border of Thailand and Laos. And he had this big building built by the king, because he was a very famous monk at that time. And Ajahn Brahm said he went to visit him. And when he went into this enormous room, into this enormous hall, all he saw was this little monk sitting on this chair in the corner, right? As if there was nobody there. With this monk sitting in this corner in there. And when you walk into this room, it was as if there was nobody there. But at the same time, this very powerful feeling of complete acceptance, of complete non-fear. There's nothing to fear from this person. And you can relax 100% in their presence. And that is the arahant, right? They don't have to open their mouth, right? Isn't that great? You say nothing. You just go into the presence and you feel, wow. Breathe. How nice it is to be in the presence of a person like that. And the Buddha says elsewhere that just seeing an arahant, just seeing a fully awakened being in this world is a great, great blessing for people because it shows you something different from what you're used to. It shows you something powerful. It shows you potential, the human potential that we all can live up to. So this is the last person. So this is the last one. Don't get upset with the arahants, right? Try to get inspired instead. Get that inspiration out of that. And then you are on the right track. So that is all I want to say tonight. I've just very briefly summarized very briefly what I've been saying. That one of the main problems on the spiritual path is the problem of anger. And remember that all you have to do to overcome anger and ill will, all you have to do is shift your attention away from those things that are problematic, those things you find difficult, to those things that are beautiful. That's all you have to do, right? That little shift away from the difficult things to the beautiful things. And then remember some of those similes that I have spoken tonight. You don't have to, but you're welcome to. And if you do that much, see if that can be of some assistance in your meditation practice. Okay, thank you. That's all I want to say. Okay, so any questions for tonight's talk? There's a microphone coming. Yeah, please. Yeah.
Thank you for tonight's talk. I really enjoyed it. Whenever I have anger, I find I chant, and that helps me to transform, to find the wisdom and the compassion. The question is, I want to ask you, you talked about anger as a destructive force. Sometimes surely anger can be used in a constructive way. For instance, if a child is being beaten, anger can give you the courage to stop, to go and face the person that's beating the child or a dog. And surely anger has motivated and been used to change many positive things in the world. I will create positive things, positive change, slavery, all those sorts of things. People can use anger actually in a positive way. Can you speak about that, please?
Okay. So the first thing you said was about chanting, that we're using chanting to overcome anger.
That's what helps me.
Okay. Yeah. Yes. That's a nice thing, especially the Metta Sutta, right? Chant the Metta Sutta, that's really good. Yeah, so you're asking about whether anger can sometimes be useful because it might give you the energy, perhaps, or the courage to kind of do out and do what is right in the world. So it's very hard to know. Maybe sometimes it works. I can't really say outright it never works. But I think that, generally speaking, there's far, far too much anger in the world. And this, I think, is the main problem. Okay, maybe occasionally there is a situation that calls for anger. But the vast majority, I think I would say 99% of anger tends to be, in my opinion, destructive. And if you can overcome things like slavery or whatever by, you know, focusing on the compassion for the slaves rather than being angry with the slave owners, for example, if you can change your focus a little bit. And sometimes the slave owners themselves are trapped, right? They are trapped into a vicious circle. They don't really understand what they're doing. They are deluded in a certain way. We're all deluded. We all make mistakes. That's just life. So by changing your perception and by trying to come from kindness, we can generally do much more good in the world. It's like if you want to motivate someone to do a job, right? There's a famous story that Ajahn Brahm always tells. This is the story of the emperor in the Chinese army. This is from, I think, a book called The Chinese Art of War or something like that. And this is the story of the general that had perfect discipline in his army. When the emperor summons this general and he asks him, how are you able to have perfect discipline in the army? It's amazing. Nobody else has that. The only general can do this. And then the answer is, it's because I only tell them what they want to do. You may have heard this before, right?
And how is that possible? How can it only tell them what to do? And the idea is that you motivate them in the right way here. You motivate them in such a way that they actually want to do these things. And if you try to motivate someone through anger, you find it's very rare that they react in such a way that they actually want to do what you say. If you are angry, people get either defensive, no, I didn't say that, I didn't do that. Or they act out of fear, right? Okay, this is too much, I can't do this, I'll do what she says regardless because fear. Or they counterattack. But it's very rare to find a person, when somebody is angry, says, let me think about that. Is she right or not? Maybe she has a good point. Usually anger stops the rational abilities of the other person. You can't really think clearly anymore. So if you can persuade somebody by compassion, by kindness, by doing the right thing in the right way, it is so much more persuasive, because then it is likely that they will listen. So I can't say with 100% certainty that there never is a case for anger. I'm not sure if there actually ever is. Maybe there is. I'll give you that much. But I would say that certainly in 99% of the cases, there are better ways of dealing with the problem than getting angry. That is my experience and also my confidence in the Buddha's teachings.
Thank you.
Yeah. Okay. Anyone else wants to say something? Over here, Hugh. Yeah, okay. Peter.
Ajahn, I was sort of under the impression that the Anagami was more harmless than the Arahat, perhaps because they have, like, greater wisdom.
The Anagami is more harmless than the Arahat.
Is that incorrect?
That is incorrect, yeah. The Arahat would be even more harmless. I think the distinction between the two is very marginal, right? They're both extremely harmless. And for the vast majority of people, wouldn't be able to tell the difference. They would look exactly the same. But the Arahat is even more, probably, well, they both have given up anger, so there won't be that much difference. The only difference is that the Anagami still has a little bit of sense of self. That's all. That's really the whole difference there. Pretty marginal, yeah. Yes, over here.
Remind you, the first bit of the cloth is you tear off the bits that are no good and you discard.
Yeah.
The second bit of cloth, I've forgotten.
The second one was the one where you plunge into the pond, right? You push aside the water plants. That was the second ceremony. You push away and then you drink the water. You drink the good qualities, right?
It's not a cloth, one cloth.
Yeah, two different similes there. Yeah. It's in. If you want to read it, it's in the Anguttara Nikaya. The fives, I think, it's number 163 or something like that. It's called the in English translation, it's called the dispelling of resentment or something like that. Okay. Anybody wants to say anything? Eddie is can always be counted on there. Okay. Okay.
Ajahn Brahmali, after hearing all this, question, came to my mind, the Buddha saying, hatred is not appeased by hatred.
Yeah.
Only by love is it quelled.
Yeah.
You know, anger and ill will, you think it's also associated with our ego too,
Yeah.
It's hard to see this fault of ours, the thing, okay?
Absolutely,
And it's a very destructive force.
Yeah.
Okay? If you have prolonged anger, ill will, this would lead to stress, anxiety, depression too, this thing, right? The whole system goes haywire.
And then
we go and see doctors, but all this psychiatry, only thing is to in Buddhist sense, is to unwind, to unwind back, to let go of all these negative things, okay? And then we become well again.
Sure, I see what you mean. I like the verse you mentioned first of all. The verse in the Dhammapada is a very nice verse. Hatred never ends through hatred. Hatred only ends through love. This is an eternal law. It's a very, very, very nice verse, and this is from the Dhammapada. So the Dhammapada is not a nice collection to get. If you want to read some nice Buddhist sayings, like you can have on your table next to you when you go to sleep or whatever, you want to kind of read one verse to inspire you to make you sleep a little bit better, right? So Dhammapada is always great. Hatred never ends with hatred, only reads through love. Okay, that's very interesting. And then you have lots of metta when you fall asleep, right? that's the theory anyway. So that's how you kind of want to do things. So thanks for that, Ed. That's a good reminder. Okay. Anyone else want to say anything? Any last comments? Last chance? Okay. Yeah, good. Yeah. All right. Okay. You know more than I do, so that's good. Yeah. Yeah. Good. Yeah. So she's saying there's a relic. We have a relic of Ajahn Chah here. Yeah. Good. The real relic is like the memory, right, of someone special. That's what really matters. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Everybody happy? Not one unhappy person down there? No. Okay. Yeah.
I just wanted to really thank you for tonight. It's been really wonderful. I just noticed that in the communication that you give when you communicate something, it seems so much easier to access those awarenesses, and almost like they just follow and follow and follow in the communication.
Mm.
And is that, I guess, the communication of the teachings verbally? They seem really powerful.
Right.
Verbal communication, as opposed to if I read something.
Oh, I see what you mean. Okay. Yeah. Well, it depends, you know. I mean, the thing is that you have the problem with the suttas is that the language is a little bit different from what you're used to, right? This is India 2,500 years ago. It's to be kind of expected that it would be a little bit different from what we're used to. Huh? So because of that, you have to kind of get used to the way they speak. Yeah? And once you get used to it, it's actually very beautiful. Huh? I must admit, I actually quite like to teach myself. When I teach these things, they come alive for me as well. And I feel inspired as well. And this is one of the reasons, one of the things I like to do, is I like to also to do retreats when I actually teach the suttas, the word of the Buddha, on retreats. Practical things, not kind of just intellectuals, but practical things. Because it brings it alive, and you meditate with it, and it kind of becomes very powerful and beautiful. Yeah. So thank you for that. Yeah. Okay. Okay, so let's pay respect to the Buddha Dhamma Sangha.
Sipati Pano Bhagavato.